This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents The Sword of Shannara by Terry Brooks, read by Scott Brick. Chapter 1. The sun was already sinking into the deep green of the hills to the west of the valley, the red and gray pink of its shadows touching the corners of the land, when Flick Ohmsford began his descent. The trail stretched out unevenly down the northern slope, winding through the huge boulders which studded the rugged terrain in massive clumps, disappearing into the thick forests of the lowlands to reappear in brief glimpses in small clearings and thinning spaces of woodland. Flick followed the familiar trail with his eyes as he trudged wearily along, his light pack slung loosely over one shoulder. His broad, wind-burned face bore a set, placid look, and only the wide gray eyes revealed the restless energy that burned beneath the calm exterior. He was a young man, though his stocky build and the grizzled brown hair and shaggy eyebrows made him look much older. He wore the loose-fitting work clothes of the Vale people, and in the pack he carried were several metal implements that rolled and clanked loosely against one another. There was a slight chill in the evening air, and Flick clutched the collar of his open wool shirt closer to his neck. His journey ahead lay through forests and rolling flatlands, the latter not yet visible to him as he passed into the forests, and the darkness of the tall oaks and somber hickories reached upward to overlap and blot out the cloudless night sky. The sun had set, leaving only the deep blue of the heavens pinpointed by thousands of friendly stars. The huge trees shut out even these, and Flick was left alone in the silent darkness as he moved slowly along the beaten path. Because he had traveled this same route 100 times, the young man noticed immediately the unusual stillness that seemed to have captivated the entire valley this evening. The familiar buzzing and chirping of insects normally present in the quiet of the night, the cries of the birds that awoke with the setting of the sun to fly in search of food, all were missing. Flick listened intently for some sound of life, but his keen ears could detect nothing. He shook his head uneasily. The deep silence was unsettling, particularly in view of the rumors of a frightening black-winged creature sighted in the night skies north of the valley only days earlier. He forced himself to whistle and turned his thoughts back to his day's work in the country just to the north of the Vale, where outlying families farmed and tended domestic livestock. He traveled to their homes every week, supplying various items that they required and bringing bits of news on the happenings of the Vale and occasionally the distant cities of the deep Southland. Few people knew the surrounding countryside as well as he did, and fewer still cared to travel beyond the comparative safety of their homes in the valley. Men were more inclined to remain in isolated communities these days and let the rest of the world get along as best it could. But Flick liked to travel outside the valley from time to time, and the outlying homesteads were in need of his services and were willing to pay him for the trouble. Flick's father was not one to let an opportunity pass him by where there was money to be made, and the arrangement seemed to work out well for all concerned. A low-hanging branch brushing against his head caused Flick to start suddenly and leap to one side. In chagrin, he straightened himself and glared back at the leafy obstacle before continuing his journey at a slightly quicker pace. He was deep in the lowland forests now, and only slivers of moonlight were able to find their way through the thick boughs overhead to light the winding path dimly. It was so dark that Flick was having trouble finding the trail, and as he studied the lay of the land ahead, he again found himself conscious of the heavy silence. It was as if all life had been suddenly extinguished, and he alone remained to find his way out of this forest tomb. Again he recalled the strange rumors. He felt a bit anxious in spite of himself and glanced worriedly around. But nothing stirred on the trail ahead nor moved in the trees about him, and he felt embarrassingly relieved. Pausing momentarily in a moonlit clearing, he gazed at the fullness of the night sky before passing abruptly into the trees beyond. He walked slowly, picking his way along the winding path that had narrowed beyond the clearing and now seemed to disappear into a wall of trees and bushes ahead. He knew that it was merely an illusion, but found himself glancing about uneasily all the same. A few moments later he was again on a wider trail and could discern bits of sky peeking through the heavy trees. He was almost to the bottom of the valley and about 2 miles from his home. He smiled and began whistling an old tavern song as he hurried on. He was so intent on the trail ahead and the open land beyond the forest that he failed to notice the huge black shadow that seemed to rise up suddenly, detaching itself from a great oak tree on his left and moving swiftly toward the path to intercept him. The dark figure was almost on top of the Veilman before Flick sensed its presence looming up before him like a great black stone which threatened to crush his smaller being. With a startled cry of fear, he leaped aside, his pack falling to the path with a crash of metal, and his left hand whipped out the long, thin dagger at his waist. Even as he crouched to defend himself, he was stayed by a commanding arm raised above the figure before him, and a strong yet reassuring voice that spoke out quickly. "Wait a moment, friend. I'm no enemy, and have no wish to harm you. I merely seek directions and would be grateful if you could show me the proper path." Flick relaxed his guard a bit and tried to peer into the blackness of the figure before him in an effort to discover some semblance of a human being. He could see nothing, however, and he moved to the left with cautious steps in an attempt to catch the features of the dark figure in the tree-shadowed moonlight. "I assure you, I mean no harm," the voice continued, as if reading the Veilman's mind. "I did not mean to frighten you, but I didn't see you until you were almost upon me, and I was afraid you might pass me by without realizing I was there." The voice stopped, and the huge black figure stood silently, though Flick could feel the eyes following him as he edged about the path to put his own back to the light. Slowly the pale moonlight began to etch out the stranger's features in vague lines and blue shadows. For a long moment the two faced one another in silence, each studying the other, Flick in an effort to decide what it was he faced, the stranger in quiet anticipation. Then suddenly the huge figure lunged with terrible swiftness, his powerful hands seizing the Veilman's wrists, and Flick was lifted abruptly off the solid earth and held high, his knife dropping from nerveless fingers as the deep voice laughed mockingly up at him. "Well, well, my young friend. What are you going to do now, I wonder? I could cut your heart out on the spot and leave you for the wolves if I chose. Couldn't I?" Flick struggled violently to free himself, terror numbing his mind to any thought but that of escape. He had no idea what manner of creature had subdued him, but it was far more powerful than any normal man, and apparently prepared to dispatch Flick quickly. Then abruptly, his captor held him out at arm's length, and the mocking voice became icy cold with displeasure. "Enough of this, boy. We have played our little game, and still you know nothing of me. I'm tired and hungry, and have no wish to be delayed on the forest trail in the chill of the evening while you decide if I am man or beast. I will set you down that you may show me the path. I warn you, do not try to run from me, or it will be the worse for you." The strong voice trailed off and the tone of displeasure disappeared as the former hint of mockery returned with a short laugh. "Besides," the figure rumbled as the fingers released their iron grip and Flick slipped to the path, "I may be a better friend than you realize." The figure moved back a step as Flick straightened himself, rubbing his wrists carefully to restore the circulation to his numbed hands. He wanted to run, but was certain that the stranger would catch him again, and this time finish him without further thought. He leaned over cautiously and picked up the fallen dagger, returning it to his belt. Flick could see the fellow more clearly now, and a quick scrutiny of him revealed that he was definitely human, though much larger than any man Flick had ever seen. He was at least 7 feet tall, but exceptionally lean, though it was difficult to be certain about this, since his tall frame was wrapped in a flowing black cloak with a loose cowl pulled close about his head. The darkened face was long and deeply lined, giving it a craggy appearance. The eyes were deep-set and almost completely hidden from view by shaggy eyebrows that knotted fiercely over a long, flat nose. A short, black beard outlined a wide mouth that was just a line on the face, a line that never seemed to move. The overall appearance was frightening, all blackness and size, and Flick had to fight down the urge building within him to make a break for the forest's edge. He looked straight into the deep, hard eyes of the stranger, though not without some difficulty, and managed a weak smile. "I thought you were a thief," he mumbled hesitantly. "You were mistaken," was the quiet retort. Then the voice softened a bit. "You must learn to know a friend from an enemy. Sometime your life may depend upon it. Now then, let's have your name."
"Flick Ohmsford."
Flick hesitated and then continued in a slightly braver tone of voice. "My father is Curzad Ohmsford. He manages an inn in Shady Vale, a mile or two from here. You could find lodging and food there." "Ah, Shady Vale," the stranger exclaimed suddenly. "Yes, that is where I am going." He paused as if reflecting on his own words. Flick watched him cautiously as he rubbed his craggy face with crooked fingers and looked beyond the forest's edge to the rolling grasslands of the valley. He was still looking away when he spoke again. "You have a brother?" It was not a question. It was a simple statement of fact. It was spoken so distantly and calmly, as if the tall stranger were not at all interested in any sort of a reply, that Flick almost missed hearing it. Then suddenly realizing the significance of the remark, he started and looked quickly at the other. "How did..." "Oh, well," the man said, "doesn't every young Valeman like yourself have a brother somewhere?" Flick nodded dumbly, unable to comprehend what it was that the other was trying to say, and wondering vaguely how much he knew about Shady Vale. The stranger was looking questioningly at him, evidently waiting to be guided to the promised food and lodging. Flick quickly turned away to find his hastily discarded pack, picked it up and slung it over his shoulder, looking back at the figure towering over him. "The path is this way." He pointed, and the two began walking. They passed out of the deep forest and entered rolling, gentle hills which they would follow to the hamlet of Shady Vale at the far end of the valley. Out of the woods it was a bright night. The moon was a full white globe overhead, its glow clearly illuminating the landscape of the valley and the path which the two travelers were following. The path itself was a vague line winding over the grassy hills and distinguishable only by occasional rain-washed ruts and flat, hard patches of earth breaking through the heavy grass. The wind had gathered strength and rushed at the two men with quick gusts that whipped at their clothing as they walked, forcing them to bow their heads slightly to shield their eyes. Neither spoke a word as they proceeded, each concentrating on the lay of the land beyond, as new hills and small depressions appeared with the passing of each traveled knoll. Except for the rushing of the wind, the night remained silent. Flick listened intently, and once he thought he heard a sharp cry far to the north, but an instant later it was gone, and he did not hear it again. The stranger appeared to be unconcerned with the silence. His attention seemed to be focused on a constantly changing point on the ground some 6 feet in front of them. He did not look up, and he did not look at his young guide for directions as they went. Instead, he seemed to know exactly where the other was going and walked confidently beside him. After a while, Flick began to have trouble keeping pace with the tall man, who traveled the path with long, swinging strides that dwarfed Flick's shorter ones. At times, the Veilman almost had to run to keep up. Once or twice, the other man glanced down at his smaller companion, and seeing the difficulty he was having in trying to match strides, slowed to an easier pace. Finally, as the southern slopes of the valley drew near, the hills began to level off into shrub-covered grasslands that hinted at the appearance of new forests. The terrain began to dip downward at a gentle slope, and Flick located several familiar landmarks that bounded the outskirts of Shady Vale. He felt a surge of relief in spite of himself. The hamlet and his own warm home were just ahead. The stranger did not speak a single word during the brief journey, and Flick was reluctant to attempt any conversation. Instead, he tried to study the giant in quick glimpses as they walked, without permitting the other to observe what he was doing. He was understandably awed. The long, craggy face, shaded by the sharp black beard, recalled the fearful warlocks described to him by stern elders before the glowing embers of a late evening fire when he was only a child. Most frightening were the stranger's eyes, or rather the deep, dark caverns beneath the shaggy brows where his eyes should be. Flick could not penetrate the heavy shadows that continued to mask that entire area of his face. The deeply lined countenance seemed carved from stone, fixed and bowed slightly to the path before it. As Flick pondered the inscrutable visage, he suddenly realized that the stranger had never even mentioned his name. The two were on the outer lip of the vale, where the now clearly distinguishable path wound through large, crowded bushes that almost choked off human passage. The tall stranger stopped suddenly and stood perfectly still, head bowed, listening intently. Flick halted beside him and waited quietly, also listening, but unable to detect anything. They remained motionless for seemingly endless minutes, and then the big man turned hurriedly to his smaller companion. "Quickly! Hide in the bushes ahead! Go now! Run!" He half-pushed, half-threw Flick in front of him as he raced swiftly toward the tall brush. Flick scurried fearfully for the sanctuary of the shrubbery, his pack slapping wildly against his back and the metal implements clanging. The stranger turned on him and snatched the pack away, tucking it beneath the long robe. "Silence," he hissed. "Run now. Not a sound." They ran quickly to the dark wall of foliage some 50 feet ahead, and the tall man hurriedly pushed Flick through the leafy branches that whipped against their faces, pulling him roughly into the middle of a large clump of brush where they stood breathing heavily. Flick glanced at his companion and saw that he was not looking through the brush at the country around them, but instead was peering upward where the night sky was visible in small, irregular patches through the foliage. The sky seemed clear to the Veilman as he followed the other's intense gaze, and only the changeless stars winked back at him as he watched and waited. Minutes passed. Once he attempted to speak, but was quickly silenced by the strong hands of the stranger, gripping his shoulders in warning. Flick remained standing, looking at the night and straining his ears for some sound of the apparent danger. But he heard nothing save their own heavy breathing and a quiet rush of wind through the weaving branches of their cover. Then, just as Flick prepared to ease his tired limbs by sitting, the sky was suddenly blotted out by something huge and black that floated overhead and then passed from sight. A moment later it passed again, circling slowly without seeming to move, its shadow hanging ominously above the two hidden travelers, as if preparing to fall upon them. A sudden feeling of terror raced through Flick's mind, trapping it in an iron web as it strained to flee the fearful madness penetrating inward. Something seemed to be reaching downward into his chest, slowly squeezing the air from his lungs, and he found himself gasping for breath. A vision passed sharply before him of a black image laced with red, of clawed hands and giant wings, of a thing so evil that its very existence threatened his frail life. For an instant the young man thought he would scream, but the hand of the stranger gripped his shoulder tightly, pulling him back from the precipice. Just as suddenly as it had appeared, the giant shadow was gone, and the peaceful sky of the patched night was all that remained. The hand on Flick's shoulder slowly relaxed its grip, and the veilman slid heavily to the ground, his body limp as he broke out in a cold sweat. The tall stranger seated himself quietly next to his companion, and a small smile crossed his face. He laid one long hand on Flick's and patted it as he would a child's. "Come now, my young friend," he whispered. "You're alive and well, and the veil lies just ahead." Flick looked up at the other's calm face, his own eyes wide with fear as he shook his head slowly. "That thing! What was that terrible thing?" "Just a shadow," the man replied easily. "But this is neither the place nor the time to concern ourselves with such matters. We will speak of it later. Right now, I would like some food and a warm fire before I lose all patience." He helped the veilman to his feet and returned his pack to him. Then, with a sweep of his robed arm, he indicated that he was ready to follow, if the other was ready to lead. They left the cover of the brush, Flick not without misgivings as he glanced apprehensively at the night sky. It almost seemed as if the whole business had been the result of an overactive imagination. Flick pondered the matter solemnly and quickly decided that, whatever the case, he had had enough for one evening. First this nameless giant, and then that frightening shadow. He silently vowed that he would think twice before traveling again at night so far from the safety of the veil. Several minutes later, the trees and brush began to thin out, and the flickering of yellow light was visible through the darkness. As they drew closer, the vague forms of buildings began to take shape as square and rectangular bulks in the gloom. The path widened into a smoother dirt road that led straight into the hamlet, and Flick smiled gratefully at the lights that shone in friendly greeting through the windows of the silent buildings. No one moved on the road ahead. If it had not been for the lights, one might well have wondered if anyone at all lived in the Vale. As it was, Flick's thoughts were far from such questions. Already he was considering how much he ought to tell his father and Shay, not wishing to worry them about strange shadows that could easily have been the product of his imagination and the gloomy night. The stranger at his side might shed some light on the subject at a later time, but so far he had not proved to be much of a conversationalist. Flick glanced involuntarily at the tall figure walking silently beside him. Again he was chilled by the blackness of the man. It seemed to reflect from his cloak and hood over his bowed head and lean hands, to shroud the entire figure in hazy gloom. Whoever he was, Flick felt certain that he would be a dangerous enemy. They passed slowly between the buildings of the hamlet, and Flick could see torches burning through the wooden frames of the wide windows. The houses themselves were long, low structures, each containing only a ground floor beneath a slightly sloping roof, which in most instances tapered off on one side to shelter a small veranda, supported by heavy poles affixed to a long porch. The buildings were constructed of wood, with stone foundations and stone frontings on a few. Flick glanced through the curtained windows, catching glimpses of the inhabitants, the sight of familiar faces reassuring to him in the darkness outside. It had been a frightening night, and he was relieved to be home among people he knew. The stranger remained oblivious to everything. He did not bother with more than a casual glance at the hamlet, and had not spoken once since they had entered the Vale. Flick remained incredulous at the way in which the other followed him. He wasn't following Flick at all, but seemed to know exactly where the Valeman was going. When the road branched off in opposite directions amid identical rows of houses, the tall man had no difficulty in determining the correct route, though he never once looked at Flick, nor even raised his head to study the road. Flick found himself trailing along while the other guided. The two quickly reached the inn. It was a large structure consisting of a main building and lounging porch, with two long wings that extended out and back on either side. It was constructed of huge logs, cut and laced on a high stone foundation and covered with a familiar wood shingle roof, this particular roof much higher than those of the family dwellings. The central building was well lighted, and muffled voices could be heard from within, interspersed with occasional laughter and shouts. The wings of the inn were in darkness. It was there that the sleeping quarters of the guests were located. The smell of roasting meat permeated the night air, and Flick quickly led the way up the wooden steps of the long porch to the wide double doors at the center of the inn. The tall stranger followed without a word. Flick slid back the heavy metal door latch and pulled on the handles. The big door on the right swung open to admit them into a large lounging room filled with benches, high-backed chairs, and several long, heavy wooden tables set against the wall to the left and rear. The room was brightly lit by the tall candles on the tables and wall racks, and by the huge fireplace built into the center of the wall on the left. Flick was momentarily blinded as his eyes adjusted to this new light. He squinted sharply, glancing past the fireplace and lounging furniture to the closed double doors at the back of the room, and over to the long serving bar running down the length of the wall to his right. The men gathered about the bar, looked up idly as the pair entered the room, their faces registering undisguised amazement at the appearance of the tall stranger. But Flick's silent companion did not seem to see them, and they quickly returned to their conversation and evening drinks, glancing back at the newcomers once or twice to see what they were going to do. The pair remained standing at the door for a few moments more as Flick looked around a second time at the faces of the small crowd to see if his father were present. The stranger motioned to the lounging chairs on the left.
"I will have a seat while you find your father. Perhaps we can have dinner together when you return."
Without further comment, he moved quietly away to a small table at the rear of the room and seated himself with his back to the men at the bar, his face slightly bowed and turned away from Flick. The Valeman watched him for a moment, then moved quickly to the double doors at the rear of the room and pushed through them to the hallway beyond. His father was probably in the kitchen, having dinner with Shay. Flick hurried down the hall past several closed doors before reaching the one that opened into the inn kitchen. As he entered, the two cooks who were working at the rear of the room greeted the young man with a cheerful good evening. His father was seated at the end of a long counter at the left. As Flick had anticipated, he was in the process of finishing his dinner. He waved a brawny hand in greeting.
"You're a bit later than usual, son," he growled pleasantly. "Come over here and have dinner while there's still something to eat."
Flick walked over wearily, lowered the traveling pack to the floor with a slight clatter, and perched himself on one of the high counter stools. His father's large frame straightened itself as he shoved back the empty plate and looked quizzically at the other, his wide forehead wrinkling.
"I met a traveler on the road coming into the valley," Flick explained hesitantly. "He wants a room and dinner. Asked us to join him."
"Well, he came to the right place for a room," the elder Ohmsford declared.
I don't see why we shouldn't join him for a bite to eat. I could easily do with another helping.
He raised his massive frame from the stool and signaled the cooks for three dinners. Flick looked about for Shay, but he was nowhere in sight. His father lumbered over to the cooks to give some special instructions on preparing the meal for the small party, and Flick turned to the basin next to the sink to wash off the dirt and grime from the road. When his father came over to him, Flick asked where his brother had gone.
"Shay has gone out on an errand for me and should return on the moment," his father replied. "By the way, what's the name of this man you brought back with you?"
"I don't know. He didn't say." Flick shrugged. His father frowned and mumbled something about close-mouthed strangers, rounding off his muffled comment with a vow to have no more mysterious types at his inn. Then, motioning to his son, he led the way through the kitchen doors, his wide shoulders brushing the wall beyond as he swung to his left toward the lounging area. Flick followed quickly, his broad face wrinkled in doubt. The stranger was still sitting quietly, his back to the men gathered at the serving bar. When he heard the rear doors swing open, he shifted about slightly to catch a glimpse of the two who entered. The stranger studied the close resemblance between father and son. Both were of medium height and heavy build, with the same broad, placid faces and grizzled brown hair. They hesitated in the doorway, and Flick pointed toward the dark figure. He could see the surprise in Curzad Ohmsford's eyes as the innkeeper regarded him for a minute before approaching. The stranger stood up courteously, towering over the other two as they came up to him.
"Welcome to my inn, stranger," the elder Ohmsford greeted him, trying vainly to peer beneath the cloak hood that shadowed the other's dark face. "My name, as my boy has probably told you, is Curzad Ohmsford."
The stranger shook the extended hand with a grip that caused the stocky man to grimace, and then nodded to Flick.
"Your son was kind enough to show me to this pleasant inn." He smiled with what Flick could have sworn was a mocking grin. "I hope you will join me for dinner and a glass of beer."
"Certainly," answered the innkeeper, lumbering past the other to a vacant chair where he seated himself heavily. Flick also pulled up a chair and sat down, his eyes still on the stranger, who was in the process of complimenting his father on having such a fine inn. The elder Ohmsford beamed with pleasure and nodded in satisfaction to Flick as he signaled one of the men at the serving bar for three glasses. The tall man still did not pull back the hood of the cloak shading his face. Flick wanted to peer beneath the shadows, but was afraid the stranger would notice, and one such attempt had already earned him sore wrists and a healthy respect for the big man's strength and temper. It was safer to remain in doubt. He sat in silence as the conversation between his father and the stranger lengthened from polite comments on the mildness of the weather to a more intimate discussion of the people and happenings of the Vale. Flick noticed that his father, who never needed much encouragement anyway, was carrying the entire conversation with only casual questions interjected by the other man. It probably did not matter, but the Ohmsfords knew nothing about the stranger. He had not even told them his name. Now, he was quite subtly drawing out information on the Vale from the unsuspecting innkeeper. The whole situation bothered Flick, but he was uncertain what he should do. He began to wish that Shay would appear and see what was happening, but his brother remained absent, and the long-awaited dinner was served and entirely consumed before one of the wide double doors at the front of the lobby swung open, and Shay appeared from out of the darkness. For the first time, Flick saw the hooded stranger take more than a passing interest in someone. Strong hands gripped the table as the black figure rose silently, towering over the Ohmsfords.
He seemed to have forgotten they were there, as the lined brow furrowed more deeply and the craggy features radiated an intense concentration. For one frightening second, Flick believed that the stranger was somehow about to destroy Shay. But then the idea disappeared and was replaced with another. The man was searching his brother's mind. He stared intently at Shay, his deep, shaded eyes running quickly over the young man's slim countenance and slight build. He noted the telltale elven features immediately, the hint of slightly pointed ears beneath the tousled blonde hair, the pencil-like eyebrows that ran straight up at a sharp angle from the bridge of the nose rather than across the brow, and the slimness of the nose and jaw. He saw intelligence and honesty in that face, and now as he faced Shay across the room, he saw determination in the penetrating blue eyes. Determination that spread in a flush over the youthful features as the two men locked their gazes on one another. For a moment, Shay hesitated in awe of the huge, dark apparition across the room. He felt unexplainably trapped, but bracing himself with sudden resolve, he walked toward the forbidding figure. Flick and his father watched Shay approach them, his eyes still on the tall stranger, and then, as if suddenly realizing who he was, the two rose from the table. There was a moment of awkward silence as they faced one another, and then all the Ohmsfords began greeting each other at once in a sudden jumble of words that relieved the initial tension. Shay smiled at Flick, but could not take his eyes off the imposing figure before him. Shay was slightly shorter than his brother and was therefore even more in the shadow of the stranger than Flick had been, though he was less nervous about it as he faced the man. Curzad Ohmsford was talking to him about his errand, and his attention was momentarily diverted while he replied to his father's insistent questions. After a few preliminary remarks, Shay turned back to the newcomer to the veil.
"I don't believe we have met, yet you seem to know me from somewhere, and I have the strangest feeling that I should know you."
The dark face above him nodded as the familiar mocking smile crossed it fleetingly. "Perhaps you should know me, though it is not surprising that you do not remember. But I know who you are. Indeed, I know you well." Shay was dumbfounded at this reply, and unable to respond, stood staring at the stranger. The other raised a lean hand to his chin to stroke the small, dark beard, glancing slowly around at the three men who waited for him to continue. Flick's open mouth was framing the question on the minds of all the Ohmsfords when the stranger reached up and pulled back the cowl of his cloak to reveal clearly the dark face, now framed by long black hair, cut nearly shoulder length and shading the deep-set eyes, which still showed only as black slits in the shadows beneath the heavy brows. "My name is Alanon," he announced quietly. There was a long moment of stunned silence as the three listeners stared in speechless amazement. Alanon, the mysterious wanderer of the four lands, historian of the races, philosopher and teacher, and some said, practitioner of the mystic arts. Alanon, the man who had been everywhere from the darkest havens of the Anar to the forbidden heights of the Charnel Mountains. His was a name familiar to the people of even the most isolated Southland communities. Now he stood unexpectedly before the Ohmsfords, none of whom had ventured outside their valley home more than a handful of times in their lives. Alanon smiled warmly for the first time, but inwardly, he felt pity for them. The quiet existence they had known for so many years was finished. And in a way, it was his responsibility.
"What brings you here?" Shay asked at last.
The tall man looked sharply at him and uttered a deep, low chuckle that caught them all by surprise.
"You, Shay," he murmured. "I came looking for you."
Chapter 2 Shay was awake early the next morning, rising from the warmth of his bed to dress hastily in the damp cold of the morning air. He had arisen so early, he discovered, that no one else in the entire inn, guest or family, was yet awake. The long building was silent as he moved quietly from his small room in the rear of the main section to the large lobby, where he quickly started a fire in the great stone hearth, his fingers almost numb with cold. The valley was always strikingly cold in the early morning hours before the sun reached the rim of the hills, even during the warmest seasons of the year. Shady Vale was well sheltered, not only from the eyes of men, but from the fury of perverse weather conditions that drifted down from the Northland. Yet while the heavy storms of the winter and spring passed over the valley and Shady Vale, the bitter cold of early morning all year round settled into the high hills, holding until the warmth of the noonday sun filtered down to chase away the chill. The fire crackled and snapped at the wood as Shay relaxed in one of the high, straight-backed chairs and pondered the events of the previous evening. He leaned back, folded his arms for warmth, and hunched down into the hard wood. How could Alanon have known him? He had seldom been out of the Vale, and would certainly have remembered the other man if he had met him while on one of his infrequent journeys. Alanon had refused to say more on the subject after that one declaration. He had finished his dinner in silence, concluding that further talk should wait until the next morning, and he became once again the forbidding figure he had first appeared when Shay entered the inn that evening. His meal completed, he had asked to be shown to his room so that he might sleep, and then excused himself. Neither Shay nor Flick could get him to say one word further about the trip to Shady Vale and his interest in Shay. The two brothers had talked alone later that night, and Flick had related the story of his encounter with Alanon and the incident with the terrifying shadow. Shay's thoughts drifted back to his initial question. How could Alanon have known him? Mentally, he retraced the events of his life. His early years were a vague memory. He did not know where he had been born, although some time after the Ohmsfords had adopted him, he had been told that his place of birth was a small Westland community. His father had died before he was old enough to form a lasting impression, and now he could recall almost nothing of him. For a time his mother had kept him, and he could recall bits and pieces of his years with her, playing with elven children, surrounded by great trees and deep green solitude. He was 5 when she became suddenly ill, and decided to return to her own people in the hamlet of Shady Vale. She must have known then that she was dying, but her first concern was for her son. The journey south was the finish for her, and she died shortly after they reached the valley. The relatives his mother had left when she married were gone, all but the Ohmsfords, who were no more than distant cousins. Curzad Ohmsford had lost his wife less than a year earlier, and was raising his son Flick while he managed the inn. Shay became a part of their family, and the two boys had grown up as brothers, both bearing the name Ohmsford. Shay had never been told his true name, nor did he care to ask. The Ohmsfords were the only family that meant anything to him, and they had accepted him as their own. There were times that being a half-blood bothered him, but Flick had stoutly insisted that it was a distinct advantage because it gave him the instincts and character of two races to build upon. Yet nowhere could he remember an encounter with Al-Anon. It was as if the event had never really occurred. Perhaps it never had. He shifted around in the chair and gazed absently into the fire. There was something about the grim wanderer that frightened him. Perhaps it was his imagination, but he could not shake off the feeling that the man could somehow read his thoughts, could see right through him whenever he chose to do so. It seemed ridiculous, but the thought had lingered with the veilman since the meeting in the lobby of the inn. Flick had remarked on it too, and he had gone further than that, whispering in the darkness of their sleeping room to his brother, fearful that he might in some way be overheard, that he felt Al-Anon was dangerous. Shay stretched himself and sighed deeply. Already it was becoming light outside. He rose to add some more wood to the fire and heard the sound of his father's voice in the hallway, grumbling loudly about matters in general. Sighing in resignation, Shay put aside his thoughts and hastened to the kitchen to help with the morning preparations. It was almost noon before Shay saw any sign of Al-Anon, who had evidently kept to his room for the duration of the morning. He appeared quite suddenly from around one corner of the inn as Shay relaxed beneath a huge shade tree at the rear of the building, absently munching on a quick luncheon he had prepared for himself. His father was occupied within, and Flick was off somewhere on an errand. The dark stranger of the previous night seemed no less forbidding in the noon sun, still a shadowed figure of tremendous height, though he appeared to have changed his cloak from black to a light gray. The lean face was slightly bowed to the path before him as he walked toward Shay and seated himself on the grass next to the veilman, gazing absently at the hilltops to the east which appeared above the trees of the hamlet. Both men were silent for several long minutes, until at last Shay could stand it no longer. "Why did you come to the Vale, Al-Anon? Why were you looking for me?" The dark face turned toward him, and a slight smile played across the lean features. "A question, my young friend, that cannot be as easily answered as you would like. Perhaps the best way in which to answer you is first to question you. Have you read anything of the history of the Northland?" He paused. "Do you know of the Skull Kingdom?" Shay stiffened at the mention of the name, a name that was synonymous with all the terrible things in life, real and imagined. A name used to frighten little children who had been bad, or to send shivers down the spines of grown men when stories were told before the dying coals of a late evening fire. It was a name that hinted of ghosts and goblins, of the sly forest gnomes of the east, and the great rock trolls of the far north. Shay looked at the grim visage before him and nodded slowly. Again, Al-Anon paused before continuing. "I am a historian, Shay, among other things. Perhaps the most widely traveled historian alive today, since few besides myself have entered the Northland in over 500 years. I know much about the race of man that none now suspect. The past has become a blurred memory. And just as well, perhaps. For the history of man has not been particularly glorious in the last 2,000 years. Men today have forgotten the past. They know little of the present and less of the future. The race of man lives almost solely in the confines of the Southland. It knows nothing at all of the Northland and its peoples, and little of the Eastland and Westland. A pity that men have developed into such a short-sighted people,
for once they were the most visionary of the races. But now they are quite content to live apart from the other races, isolated from the problems of the rest of the world. They remain content, mind you, because those problems have not as yet touched them, and because a fear of the past has persuaded them not to look too closely at the future. Shay felt slightly irritated by these sweeping accusations, and his reply was sharp. "You make it sound like a terrible thing to want to be left alone. I know enough history. No, I know enough life to realize that man's only hope for survival is to remain apart from the races, to rebuild everything he has lost over the last 2,000 years. Then perhaps he will be smart enough not to lose it a second time. He almost destroyed himself entirely in the Great Wars by his persistent intervention in the affairs of others and his ill-conceived rejection of an isolation policy." Al-Anon's dark face turned hard. "I am well aware of the catastrophic consequences brought about by those wars, the products of power and greed that the race of man brought down on its own head through a combination of carelessness and remarkable short-sightedness. That was long ago. And what has changed? You think that man can start again, do you, Shay? Well, you might be quite surprised to learn that some things never change, and the dangers of power are always present, even to a race that almost completely obliterated itself. The great wars of the past may be gone. The wars of the races, of politics and nationalism, and the final ones of sheer energy, of ultimate power. But we face new dangers today, and these are more of a threat to the existence of the races than were any of the old. If you think man is free to build a new life while the rest of the world drifts by, then you do not know anything of history." He paused suddenly, his grim features lined with anger. Shay stared back defiantly, though within he felt small and frightened. "Enough of this," Al-Anon began again, his face softening as one strong hand reached up to grip Shay's shoulder in friendship. "The past is behind us, and it is with the future that we must concern ourselves. Let me refresh your memory for a moment on the history of the Northland and the legend of the Skull Kingdom. As you know, I'm sure, the Great Wars brought an end to an age where man alone was the dominant race. Man was almost completely destroyed, and even the geography he had known was completely altered, completely restructured. Countries, nations, and governments all ceased to exist as the last members of the human race fled south to survive. It was nearly 1,000 years before man had once again raised himself above the standard of the animals he hunted for food and established a progressive civilization. It was primitive, to be sure, but there was order and a semblance of government. Then man began to discover there were other races besides himself inhabiting the world. Creatures who had survived the great wars and developed their own races. In the mountains were the huge trolls, powerful and ferocious, but quite content with what they had. In the hills and forests were the small and cunning creatures we now call gnomes. Many a battle was fought between men and gnomes for the rights to land during the years following the great wars, and the battles hurt both races. But they fought to survive, and reason has no place in the mind of a creature fighting for its life. Man also discovered that there was another race, a race of men who had fled beneath the earth to survive the effects of the great wars. Years of living in the huge caverns beneath the Earth's crust, away from the sunlight, altered their appearance. They became short and stocky, powerful in the arms and chest, with strong, thick legs for climbing and scrambling underground. Their sight in the dark became superior to that of other creatures, yet in the sunlight they could see little. They lived beneath the earth for many hundreds of years, until at last they began to emerge to live again on the face of the land. Their eyes were very bad at first, and they made their homes in the darkest forests of the Eastland. They developed their own language, though they later reverted to the language of man. When man first discovered remnants of this lost race, they called them dwarfs, after a fictional race of the old days. His voice trailed off, and he remained silent for a few minutes, staring out at the tips of the hills, showing brilliant green in the sunlight. Shay considered the historian's comments. He had never seen a troll, and only one or two gnomes and dwarves, and those he did not remember very well. "What about the elves?" he asked finally. Elanon looked back thoughtfully and bowed his head a little more. "Ah, yes. I had not forgotten. A remarkable race of creatures, the elves. Perhaps the greatest people of all, though no one has ever fully realized it. But the tale of the elven people must wait for another time. Suffice to say that they were always there in the great forests of the Westland, though the other races seldom encountered them at this stage of history. Now we shall see how much you know of the history of the Northland, my young friend. Today it is a land inhabited by almost no one other than the trolls, a barren and forbidding country where few people of any race care to travel, let alone settle. The trolls, of course, are bred to survive there. Today men live in the warmth and comfort of the Southland's mild climate and green lands. They have forgotten that once the Northland, too, was settled by creatures of all the races. Not only the trolls in the mountain regions, but men, dwarves, and gnomes in the lowlands and forests. This was in the years when all the races were just beginning to rebuild a new civilization with new ideas, new laws, and many new cultures. It was a very promising future, but men today have forgotten that those times ever existed. Forgotten that they are more than a beaten race, trying to live apart from those who defeated them and crippled their pride. There was no division of countries then. It was an earth reborn, where each race was being given a second chance at building a world. Of course, they did not realize the significance of the opportunity. They were too concerned with holding what they considered theirs and building their own private little worlds. Each race was certain that it was destined to be the dominant power in the years ahead, gathered together like a pack of angry rats guarding a stale, sorry piece of cheese. And man, oh yes, in all his glory, was groveling and snapping at the chance just like the others. Did you know that, Shay? The Veilman shook his head slowly, unable to believe that what he was hearing could be the truth. He had been told that man had been a persecuted people ever since the Great Wars, fighting to keep alive his dignity and honor, to protect the little land that was his in the face of complete savagery on the part of the other races. Man had never been the oppressor in these battles. Always he was the oppressed. Alanon smiled grimly, his lips curling with mocking satisfaction as he saw the effect of his words. You didn't realize that it was this way, I see. No matter. It will be the least of the surprises I have in store for you. Man has never been the great people he has fancied himself. In those days men fought like the rest, although I will concede that perhaps they had a higher sense of honor and a clearer purpose to rebuild than some of the others, and they were slightly more civilized. He twisted the word meaningfully as he spoke it, lacing it with undisguised sarcasm. But all this commentary has little to do with the main point of our discussion, which I hope to make clear to you shortly. It was about this same time, when the races had discovered one another and were fighting for dominance, that the Druid Council first opened the halls of Perenor in the lower Northland. History is rather vague about the origins and purposes of the Druids, though it is believed they were a group of highly knowledgeable men from all the races, skilled in many of the lost arts of the old world. They were philosophers and visionaries, students of the arts and science all at once. But more than this, they were the teachers of the races. They were the givers of power, the power of new knowledge in the ways of life. They were led by a man named Gallifile, a historian and philosopher like myself, who called the greatest men of the land together to form a council to establish peace and order. He relied on their learning to hold sway over the races, their ability to give knowledge to gain the people's confidence. The Druids were a very powerful force during those years, and the plan of Gallifile seemed to be working as anticipated. But as time passed, it became apparent that some of the members of the council had powers far surpassing those of the others, powers that had lain dormant and gathered strength in a few phenomenal, genius minds. It would be difficult to describe those powers to you without taking quite some time, more time than we have available to us. What is important for our purposes is to recognize that some among the council who possessed the very greatest minds became convinced that they were destined to shape the future of the races. In the end, they broke from the council to form their own group, and for some time disappeared and were forgotten. About 150 years later, there occurred a terrible civil war within the race of man, which eventually widened into the First War of the Races, as the historians named it. Its cause was uncertain even then, and has now almost been forgotten. In simple terms, a small sector of the race of man revolted against the teachings of the council, and formed a very powerful and highly trained army. The proclaimed purpose of the uprising was the subjugation of the rest of man under a central rule for the betterment of the race and the furthering of its pride as a people. Eventually, almost all segments of the race rallied to the new cause, and war was begun upon the other races, ostensibly to accomplish this new goal. The central figure behind the war was a man called Brona, an archaic gnome term for master. It was said that he was the leader of the Druids of the First Council who had broken away and disappeared into the Northland. No reliable source ever reported seeing him or talking with him, and in the end it was concluded that Brona was merely a name, a fictitious character. The revolt, if you care to call it such, was finally crushed by the combined power of the Druids and the other allied races. Did you know of this, Shay? The Veilman nodded and smiled slightly.
I have heard of the Druid Council, of its purposes and work. All ancient history since the Council died out long ago. I have heard of the First War of the Races, though not in the same way as you tell it. prejudiced, I believe you would call my version. The war was a bitter lesson for man.
Elanon waited patiently and did not speak as Shay paused to reflect on his own knowledge of the past before continuing. I know that the survivors of our race fled south after the war was over and have remained there ever since, rebuilding again the homes and cities lost, trying to create life rather than destroy it. You seem to think of it as an isolation born of fear, but I believe it was and still is the best way to live. Central governments have always been the greatest danger to mankind. Now there are none. Small communities are the new rule of life. Some things are better left alone by everyone.
The tall man laughed, a deep, mirthless chuckle that made Shay feel suddenly foolish.
You know so little, though what you say is true enough. Truisms, my young friend, are the useless children of hindsight. Well, I don't propose to argue with you now on the fine points of social reform, let alone political activism. That will have to wait until another time. Tell me what you know of the creature called Brona. Perhaps... No. Wait a moment. Someone is coming. The words were scarcely out of his mouth before the stocky figure of Flick appeared around the corner of the inn. The veilman stopped abruptly as he saw Al-Anon and hesitated until Shay waved to him. He came over slowly and remained standing, his eyes on the dark face as the big man smiled slowly down at him, the familiar enigmatic twist at the corners of his mouth.
I was just wondering where you had gone, Flick began, speaking to his brother, and didn't mean to interrupt.
You are not interrupting anything, Shay replied quickly. But Al-Anon seemed to disagree.
This conversation was for your ears alone, he declared flatly. If your brother chooses to stay, he will have decided his own fate in the days to come. I would strongly suggest that he not remain to hear the rest of our discussion, but forget that we ever talked. Still, it is his own choice.
The brothers looked at each other, unable to believe that the tall man was serious. But his grim face indicated that he was not joking, and for a moment both men hesitated, reluctant to say anything. Finally, Flick spoke.
I have no idea what you're talking about. But Shay and I are brothers, and what happens to one must happen to both. If he's in any trouble, I should share it with him. It's my own choice, I'm sure.
Shay stared at him in amazement. He had never heard Flick sound more positive about anything in his entire life. He felt proud of his brother and smiled up at him gratefully. Flick winked back quickly and sat down, not looking at Al-Anon. The tall traveler stroked his small, dark beard with a lean hand and smiled quite unexpectedly.
Indeed, the choice is your own, and you have proven yourself a brother by your words. But it is deeds that make the difference. You may regret the choice in the days to come.
He trailed off, lost in thought as he studied the bowed head of Flick for several long moments before turning to Shay.
Well, I cannot begin my story again just for your brother. He will have to follow as best he can. Now tell me what you know of Brona.
Shay thought silently for a few minutes and then shrugged.
I really don't know much of anything about him. He was a myth, as you said, the fictional leader of the uprising, the First War of the Races. He was supposed to have been a druid who left the council and used his own evil power to master the minds of his followers. Historically, he was never seen, never captured or killed in the final battle. He never existed.
Historically accurate, I'm sure, muttered Al-Anon. What you know of him in connection with the Second War of the Races?
Shea smiled briefly at the question. Well, legend has it that he was the central force behind that war also. But it turned out to be just another myth. He was supposed to be the same creature who had organized the armies of man in the First War, except in this one he was called the Warlock Lord, the evil counterpart to the Druid Bremen. I believe Bremen was supposed to have killed him in the Second War, however. But all that was only fantasy.
Flick hastened to nod his agreement, but Alanon said nothing. Shea waited for some form of confirmation, openly amused by the whole subject.
"Where is all this talk taking us anyway?" he asked after a moment.
Alanon glanced down at him sharply, cocking one dark eyebrow in wonder.
"Your patience is remarkably limited, Shea. After all, we have just covered in a matter of minutes the history of 1,000 years. However, if you think you can restrain yourself for a few moments longer, I believe I can promise you that your question will be answered."
Shea nodded, feeling no little mortification at the reprimand. It was not the words themselves that hurt. It was the way Alanon said them, with that mocking smile and ill-concealed sarcasm. The Veilman regained his composure quickly, though, and shrugged his willingness to allow the historian to continue at his own pace.
"Very well," the other acknowledged. "I shall try to complete our discussion quickly. What we have spoken of up to this point has been background history to what I will now tell you. The reason why I came to find you. I recall to your memory the events of the Second War of the Races, the most recent war in the new history of man, fought less than 500 years ago in the Northland. Man had no part in this war. Man was the defeated race of the first, living deep in the heart of the Southland, a few small communities trying hard to survive the threat of total extinction. This was a war of the great races, the elven people and the dwarfs fighting against the power of the savage rock trolls and the cunning gnomes. After the completion of the First War of the Races, the known world partitioned into the existing 4 lands, and the races were at peace for quite a long time. During this period, the power and influence of the Druid Council diminished greatly as the apparent need for its assistance seemed to have ceased. It is only fair to add that the Druids had grown lax in their attention to the races, and over a period of years the new members lost sight of the Council's purposes and turned away from the people's problems to more personal concerns, leading a more isolated existence of study and meditation. The elven people were the most powerful race, but confined themselves to their isolated homeland, deep in the west, where they were content to remain in relative isolation. A mistake they were to regret deeply. The other peoples scattered and developed into smaller, less unified societies, primarily in the Eastland, though some groups did settle in parts of the Westland and Northland in the border countries. The Second War of the Races began when a huge army of trolls came down out of the Charnel Mountains and seized all of the Northland, including the Druid Fortress at Perenor. The Druids had been betrayed from within by several of their own people, who had been won over by promises and offers from the enemy commander, who, at this time, was unknown. The remaining Druids, except for a very few who escaped or were away, were captured and thrown into the dungeons of the keep and never seen again. Those who had escaped the fate of their brothers scattered about the 4 lands and went into hiding. The troll army immediately moved against the dwarf people in the Eastland with the obvious intent of crushing all resistance as quickly as possible. But the dwarfs gathered deep within the huge forests of the Anar, which only they know well enough to survive in for any length of time, and there held firm against the advances of the troll armies, despite the aid being given by a few of the gnome tribes who had joined the invasion force. The dwarf king Raber recorded in his own people's history whom he had discovered the real enemy to be. The rebel druid, Brona.
"How could the dwarf king believe this?" Shay interjected quickly. "If it were true, the warlock lord would be over 500 years old. At any rate, I should think that some ambitious mystic must have suggested the idea to the king, with the thought of reviving an old, outdated myth, perhaps to better his own position in the court or something."
"That is a possibility," Alanon conceded. But let me continue the story. After long months of fighting, the trolls were evidently led to believe that the dwarfs had been beaten, so they turned their war legions to the west and began to march against the powerful elven kingdom. But during the months the trolls had battled the dwarf people, the few druids who had escaped from Paranor had been assembled by the famous mystic Bremen, an old and highly esteemed elder of the council. He led them to the elven kingdom in the Westland to warn the people there of this new threat, and to prepare for the almost certain invasion of the Northlanders. The elven king in that year was Gerald Shannara, the greatest of all the elven kings, perhaps, with the exception of Eventime. Bremen warned the king of the probable assault on his lands, and the elven ruler quickly prepared his armies before the advancing troll hordes had reached their borders. I'm sure you know your history well enough to remember what happened when the battle was fought, Shay, but I want you to pay attention to the particulars of what I tell you next. Both Shay and an excited Flick nodded. The druid Bremen gave to Gerald Shannara a special sword for the battle against the trolls. Whoever held the sword was supposed to be invincible, even against the awesome power of the warlock lord. When the troll legions entered the Valley of Wrenn in the borderlands of the elven kingdom, they were attacked and trapped by the armies of the elven people, fighting from higher ground, and were badly beaten in a 2-day pitched battle. The elves were led by the druids and Gerald Shannara, who carried the great sword given him by Bremen. They fought together against the troll armies, who were said to have had the added might of beings from the spirit world under the domination of the warlock lord. But the courage of the elven king and the power of the fabulous sword overwhelmed the spirit creatures and destroyed them. When the remainder of the troll army attempted to escape back to the safety of the Northland across the plains of Strelaheim, it was caught between the pursuing army of elves and an army of dwarfs approaching from the Eastland. There was a terrible battle fought in which the troll army was destroyed almost to the last man. During the battle, Bremen disappeared while in combat at the side of the elven king, facing the warlock lord himself. It was recorded that both druid and warlock were lost in the fighting, and neither was ever seen again. Not even the bodies were found. Gerald Shannara carried the famous sword given him until his death some years later. His son gave the weapon to the druid council at Paranor, where the blade was set in a huge block of treystone and placed in a vault in the druid's keep. I'm sure you are quite familiar with the legend of the sword and what it stands for, what it means to all the races.
The great sword rests today at Perenor just as it has for 500 years. Have I been sufficiently lucid in my narration, Veilman?
Flick nodded in dumbfounded wonder, still caught up in the excitement of the history. But Shay suddenly decided that he had heard enough. Nothing that Alanon had told them of the history of the races was fact. Not if he was to believe what he had been taught by his own people since he was a child. The big man had simply related to them a childhood fantasy that had been passed down through the ages from parents to small children. He had listened patiently to everything Alanon had falsely represented to be the truth about the races, humoring him out of respect for his reputation. But the entire tale of the sword was ridiculous, and Shay was through being played for a fool. "What has all this got to do with your coming to Shady Vale?" he persisted, a faint smile betraying his disgust. "We've heard all about a battle that took place some 500 years ago, a battle that did not even concern man, but trolls and elves and dwarfs and goodness knows what else, as you tell it. Did you say there were spirits or something? I'm sorry if I sound incredulous, but I find this whole tale a little hard to swallow. The story of the Sword of Gerald Shannara is well known to all the races, but it's only fiction, not fact. A glorified story of heroism created to stir up a sense of loyalty and duty in the races that have a part in its history. But the legend of Shannara is a tale for children that adults must outgrow as they accept the responsibilities of manhood. Why did you waste time relating this fairy tale when all I want is a simple answer to a simple question? Why are you looking for me?
Shay stopped short as he saw Alanon's dark features tighten and grow black with anger, the great brows knitting over sudden pinpoints of light in the deep shadows that hid the eyes. The tall man seemed to be fighting to contain some terrible fury within, and for a moment it appeared to Shay that he was about to be strangled by the huge hands that locked before his face as the man glared in open rage. Flick moved back hastily and tripped over his own feet in the process, fear welling up inside.
"Fool! You fool!" rasped the giant in barely controlled fury. "You know so little. Children! What does the race of man know of truth? Where has man been but hiding, creeping in terror under piteous shelters in the deepest regions of the Southland, like frightened rabbits? You dare to tell me that I speak of fairy tales? You, who have never known strife, safe here in your precious vale. I came to find the bloodline of kings, but I have found a little boy who hides himself in falsehoods. You are nothing but a child."
Flick was fervently wishing he could sink into the ground beneath his feet, or perhaps simply vanish, when to his utter astonishment he saw Shay leap to his feet before the tall man, his lean features flushed in fury, and his hands knotted into fists as he braced himself. The Veilman was so overcome with anger that he could not speak, and stood before his accuser, shaking with rage and humiliation. But Alanon was not impressed, and his deep voice sounded again.
"Hold, Shay. Do not be a greater fool. Pay attention to what I tell you now. All that I told you has come down through the ages as legend, and was so told to the race of man. But the time for fairy tales is ended. What I have told you is not legend. It is the truth. The sword is real. It rests today at Perenor. But most important of all, the warlock lord is real.
He lives today, and the Skull Kingdom is his domain.
Shay started, suddenly realizing that the man was not deliberately lying after all, that he did not believe this to be a fairy tale. He relaxed and sat down, slowly, his gaze still riveted on the dark face. Abruptly, he recalled the historian's words.
You said, king? You were looking for a king?
What is the legend of the Sword of Shannara, Shay? What does the inscription carved into the block of Treystone read?
Shay was dumbfounded, unable to recall any legend at all.
I don't know. I can't remember what it said. Something about the next time?
A son, spoke up Flick suddenly from the other side. When the warlock lord appeared again in the Northland, a son of the House of Shannara would come forth to take up the sword against him. That was the legend.
Shay looked over at his brother, remembering then what the inscription was supposed to read. He looked back at Alanon, who was watching him intently.
How does this concern me? He asked quickly. I'm not a son of the House of Shannara. I'm not even elven. I'm a half-blood. Not an elf, not a king. Eventine is the heir to the House of Shannara.
Are you telling me that I'm a lost son? A missing heir? I don't believe it.
He looked quickly to Flick for support, but his brother appeared to be completely lost, staring in bewilderment at the face of Alanon. The dark man spoke quietly.
You do have elven blood in you, Shay, and you are not the true son of Khurzad Ohmsford. That you must know. And Eventine is not directly of the blood of Shannara.
I have always known that I was an adopted son, the Veilman admitted. But surely I could not have come from... Flick, tell him!
But his brother just stared at him in astonishment, unable to frame an answer to the question.
Shay stopped speaking abruptly, shaking his head in disbelief.
Alanon nodded.
You are a son of the House of Shannara. A half-son only, however, and far removed from the direct line of descent that can be traced down through the last 500 years. I knew you as a child, Shay, before you were taken into the Ohmsford household as their own son. Your father was elven, a very fine man. Your mother was of the race of man. They both died when you were still very young, and you were given to Khurzad Ohmsford to raise as his own son. But you are a son of Gerald Shannara, albeit a distant son, and not of pure elven blood.
Shane nodded absently at the tall man's explanation, confused and still suspicious. Flick was looking at his brother as if he had never seen him before.
What does all this mean? He asked Alanon eagerly.
What I have told you is known also to the Lord of Darkness, though he does not yet know where you live or who you are. But his emissaries will find you sooner or later, and when they do, you will be destroyed.
Shay's head jerked up, and he looked at Flick fearfully, remembering the tale of the huge shadow seen near the lip of the veil. His brother, too, felt a sudden chill, recalling that awful feeling of terror.
"But why?" asked Shay quickly. "What have I done to deserve that?"
"You must understand many things, Shay, before you can understand the answer to that question," replied Alanon. "And I have not the time to explain them all now. You must believe me when I tell you that you are descended from Gerald Shannara, that you are of elven blood, and that the Ohmsfords are a foster family to you. You were not the only son of the House of Shannara, but you are the only son who survives today. The others were elven, and they were easily found and destroyed. That is what prevented the Dark Lord from finding you for so long. He was unaware that there was a half-son alive in the Southland. The Elvenkin he knew of from the first. But know this, Shay. The power of the sword is unlimited. It is the one great fear with which Brona lives, the one power he may not withstand. The legend of the sword is a powerful amulet in the hands of the races, and Brona means to put an end to the legend. He will do this by destroying the entire House of Shannara, so that no son will come forth to draw the sword against him.
But I did not even know of the sword, protested Shay. I did not even know who I was, or anything about the Northland, or about...
It does not matter, cut in Alanon sharply. If you are dead, there can be no doubt about you. His voice died away in a weary murmur, and he turned to look again at the distant mountaintops beyond the fringe of tall elms. Shay lay back slowly on the soft grass, staring at the pale blue of the late winter sky laced with small, soft wisps of white cloud that drifted from the tall hills. For a few pleasant moments, the presence of Alanon and the threat of death were submerged in the sleepy warmth of the afternoon sun and the fresh smell of the lofty trees towering over him. He closed his eyes and thought of his life in the Vale, of the plans that he had made with Flick, of their hopes for the future. They would all go up in smoke if what he had been told were true. He lay quietly considering these things, and finally sat up, his arms braced behind him. "I'm not sure what to think," he began slowly. "There's so many questions I have to ask you. I feel confused by the whole idea of being someone other than an Ohmsford. Someone threatened with death at the hands of a myth. What do you suggest that I do?" Alanon smiled warmly for the first time. "For the moment, do nothing. There is no immediate danger to you. Think about what I have told you, and we will speak further of the implications another time. I shall be glad to answer all your questions then. But do not talk about this to anyone else, not even your father. Act as if this conversation had never taken place until we have a chance to work out the problems further." The young men looked at each other and nodded in agreement.